Hi, Al Weinrub. Welcome again to KABU here in Portland, Oregon.
Thank you, Bill.
Al Weinrub started out as a physicist, early on recognized the dangers of global warming, then left a academic career to become a community organizer, not just warning us about global warming, but building movements that could lead to the reconstruction necessary to save us from unimaginable catastrophe on an uninhabitable planet. To that aim, he co-founded the local Clean Energy Alliance of the Bay Area, also wrote the classic book Community Power, Decentralized Renewable Energy in California, and co-edited the book Energy Democracy. So Al, this is the second and last part of our interview. In part one last week, we compared two contesting plans for stopping climate cataclysm. We demonstrated that the corporate plan, with its huge remote nuclear plants and sun and wind farms connected to the cities by a fantastically expensive continent-spanning supergrid, would hardly get off the ground in the time available. In contrast, the left plan, the alternative to the corporate plan, is already operating in some cities around the globe. That alternative, a decentralized network of community energy agencies building out sun and wind installations, small and big, all near the point of use, employing proven off-the-shelf technology. The decentralized network, it's clearly to be far more reliable, far less expensive, and far faster to build out than the corporate disaster in the making. This week, we'll be discussing the troubles that community energy agencies have in building out their systems, financial problems, ideological problems, problems because U.S. corporations dominate our economy and state, and among those corporations are the investor-owned utilities trying to destroy the community energy agencies. Then there's troubles of their own making that leads them to buying power from faraway producers rather than building out the local system. And finally, there are problems that magnify the other problems. That is the problem that magnifies the other problem. There's little time remaining. Maybe 10 years, maybe 15, say the climate scientists who vastly reduce greenhouse gas emissions and stop global warming. Later today, we'll pivot from problems and troubles to discuss what can and must be done to overcome those problems and build out the decentralized, democratized local sun and wind energy system in the little time left. So, Al, tell us about the troubles and barriers that community energy agencies face.
Bill, what you say is right, is that remote energy is always touted as being low cost. And that's always been a fiction. And it comes from the fact that when the utilities are talking, they're always talking cost, but they're never talking benefit, right? Because whatever the cost is, they're the ones that are reaping the benefits. But when we shift our orientation to looking at the community and what the community needs, we think a lot more in terms of cost-benefit relationships. So it's not about cost. It's not primarily about cost. It's what you get for those costs. And the question of benefits comes in. Now, of course, the utilities don't care about community benefits. They only care about their own bottom line. So when they say it's cheaper out in the desert to get electricity, I mean, what they're not mentioning is that, by the way, that means we build these transmission lines that are needed to carry that electricity. And in terms of the model that most private utilities use, like especially the monopoly utilities in California, which I'm familiar with, but it's a general notion, is that their business model, their profit model is that they get a fixed return, a guaranteed return on infrastructure investments. That's where they make their money. So the more they build in terms of infrastructure, the more profit they make. And the less they build, that's the extent to which it undermines their business model. And the utility industry understood that going back to, you know, basically 2013, almost 8-9 years ago, when they said, wait a minute, all this rooftop solar that people are building or trying to build, let's put it that way, it was sort of at the beginning of the growth. They said people are providing electricity to themselves and their communities that doesn't require new transmission lines. That's going to be a problem because to the extent that that load grows, you know, that departing load, we'll call it departing load because it's load, it's like electricity that the utilities no longer have to provide because we're providing it on our own. To the extent that that happens, there's nothing to invest in. And so our whole profit model goes into the dumper, and it was called the utility death spiral, in fact. That's what they called it. And so they launched this big campaign, you know, to stop what we call rooftop solar or what's called solar self-generation or by other people behind the meter solar, the notion that people can put solar panels up on their own property, schools, community centers, churches, you name it, right? It's a way of basically people deciding that they could shield themselves from the abuses of utilities by, you know, putting their own power on in their own buildings. So this is a piece that they don't talk about when they say electricity is cheaper, because they're not talking about the transmission costs that we all pay. In California, 2/3 of our bill is on the transmission side, and distribution side, it's not for the electricity itself.
Yeah, besides that, of course, in the benefit side, it's far more reliable. They're up and down, the pylons are vulnerable, and in the cities, if a storm, if you get a big storm and things blow down, the repair crews are out there in the afternoon. When you get a pylon on the top of a mountain, it can take months before you get electricity. It's sort of baloney, their claim that they're in fact more reliable. They obviously aren't, in fact. The grids also have caused fires. They're constantly being shut down when the wind is blowing and there's a possibility even of a fire. But of course, the utilities don't mention the many, many benefits of local energy, including jobs and keeping money in the community and getting jobs for people who are in poor communities who desperately need them now at decent rates of pay.
What you're pointing to, Bill, is the fact that, you know, the cost-benefit calculation has been changing, and it's been changing rapidly. So we could always point to the fact that local renewable development of all kinds of resources, including energy efficiency and battery storage and whatnot, always had huge benefits to our local communities economically and environmentally, and even our ability to try to address social injustices. But what's happened is, because of the changing climate and the vulnerability of the centralized energy model, we now have like a whole new factors coming in, which is that these large transmission lines create huge risk because they can spark fires, or when they go down, people are left without power, but also risk because the utilities are shutting down power in a preemptive strike against wildfires and other things. So now this cost-benefit analysis has changed to the point where the resilience value of local energy development and deployment is hugely larger than it was before. And on the other hand, the liabilities of the centralized energy model is already escalating rates in order to be able to deal with the damages of fires and other problems, as well as repair the transmission system and everything else. So yes, that whole balance between cost benefit is shifting dramatically.
That was Al Weinrub. We just discussed today the problems community energy faces, including corporate domination of the economy and state, and hostility and suppression by the investor-owned utilities. And unfortunately, sometimes those same utilities, there's parts of their leadership at the mid-level, management levels, is hired by the boards of the community energy agencies who get taken in by the supposed expertise of those leaders. So let's switch gears some. Despite all the problems they face, still people are struggling. Decentralized energy production is still growing. What's your sense of how the decentralized confederated system could prevail? And at some point, its movements gain sufficient political power to direct the great mobilization of all our resources in cooperation across the globe that will be necessary. Do you see any road to gaining power, to organizing the maybe 25 other substantial greenhouse gas emitting countries in a planet-wide cooperative effort? What's your sense? Are there grounds for hope?
Well, as we've been talking, you know, this transition to renewable energy is really not a technical transition. We have the technologies. It's really a struggle for power, for political and economic power. And, you know, we know we've had a climate movement developing over many years, at least in the U.S., you know, to sort of counteract the fossil fuel industry and call for a transition to renewable energy. But, you know, one of the shortcomings of that movement is that it hasn't talked about what the solution space has to look like. And we've been talking about how the decentralized energy model is the direction, you know, that we have to go. And there has been in this country building over time, over the last half dozen years or so, movement that's really advocating for more decentralized models of renewable energy. And it's important to connect that movement also with the whole racial reckoning that's going on in this country. It's really important because the folks that are in the leadership of the decentralized energy movement, if you want to call it that, we actually call it the Movement for Energy Democracy. It's a movement to democratize energy resources. In other words, for communities and people, you know, to have more control and ownership of energy resources and decision-making power, you know. So this is where the question of the struggle for power really comes up. So this notion that we should have more decentralized energy systems is really part of a movement to democratize energy. And that movement has been growing over the last many years as there's been a shift in thinking about how the question of energy is really a question of democracy. And then that brings to the fore immediately different political forces and who's in motion. And it's not by accident that the folks that are in the leadership of the energy democracy movement are basically people of color, low-income people, largely women who've been in the leadership of this movement, because you can't separate the questions of democracy from racial justice, and you can't separate environmental justice, which has been a growing movement in this country, from questions of energy justice. It's all the same thing. So essentially what's been happening is that the contours of the movement have been changing, where a movement that was more like what we call carbon fundamentalist, you know, we got to reduce carbon and move to, you know, renewable forms of energy, is moving much more toward a movement for climate justice, which is really a movement for democracy and a movement against injustices. And so people of color are really in the leadership of that movement. And that's a very hopeful sign, because as we know in this country, that communities of color have often been in the forefront of movements that are important for the survival and the health of all of us. So I'm quite hopeful that, you know, that movement will grow.
Al, it seems to me that the idea of local energy and its resilience really is growing. I have one last thing I want to bring up with you. My sense is that the corporate establishment is really well secure in the United States right now. And we could build up the system so that people understand us, that there's a contender for managing and we're built for creating energy that we need and managing the system, that it doesn't have to be done by the IOUs. We can certainly, I think, create knowledge of that alternative. It seems to me that it's, of course, the time problem. My sense is that within the climate scientists say it, it's not my sense, I'm repeating them, we have less than 10 years, in fact, to make vast reductions in greenhouse gas emissions, or else feedback loops are likely to get generated, which on their own, without any more human emissions of greenhouse gases, that the concentrations will continue to go up, including by this, the decay of all of the vegetable matter that's in the tundras and in areas called swamps. And once droughts come, there's so many ways that greenhouse gas emissions could greatly increase just from natural sources. So if we have 10 years, we're pretty certain that the storms are going to get greater, the damage is going to be greater, the oceans will keep rising, the coastal cities, Miami and parts of Louisiana and California could be underwater, parts of New York City. They're talking about building this humongous, enormous, expensive system of dikes and barriers. There's going to be enormous amount of damage. There's going to be life loss. Infrastructure, particularly in rural areas, is going to be destroyed. People are going to wake up. It seems to me they're going to realize that the corporate people have not much interest, nor are they acting on the actual possibilities of doing stopping climate change by having a decentralized energy system that would also have as one of its major goals energy conservation and use reduction, which is so possible in the United States. We waste so much energy. It would be much cheaper to build up. It would take very, very small sums in comparison to what the losses would be to build very reliable and efficient energy systems in a local areas. So Now, what do you think? At some point, it seems to me the people are going to wake up and our alternative will begin looking much more attractive. Anyway, that's my hope. Why don't you comment on it?
Yes, well, the issue about what will happen in the future as climate conditions accentuate and accelerate and create more and more havoc and chaos, you know, it depends on the kind of movement and the kind of political organizing that we do. I just want to make a couple of comments. I mean, one is there's clearly a climate emergency, but there was a climate emergency in 1992, you know, when people started to understand what's going on. And there's been 30 years of all this talk about changing to renewable and whatnot that basically it seemed very abstract to most of the population. And so the fact that there's a climate emergency is not really anything new. And it's a very dangerous concept in a certain way, because for most people, what a climate emergency means is that we have to reduce carbon reductions. And what that means is that we really forget about questions of decentralized energy and equity and what's in the benefit of most of the people of the country. And so basically, a lot of the climate emergency forces are actually folks whose program represents a lot of white privilege and a lot of sort of attitudes of, well, we'll deal with racism later, and we're dealing with the climate right now. So the climate emergency kind of framing to the question, as compared to a climate justice framing, is actually not a positive force in my mind. Clearly, there is an emergency, but the question is how you deal with it is what's important. And if you don't deal with it in a way that provides for justice and that addresses injustices, it means that politically it's not really going to happen. You're not going to build the kind of political strength you need to be able to move in a positive direction. So if people are holding on to sort of essentially a, you know, a white privilege approach to dealing with the climate, then they will fail and we will all fail with it. This is why I spoke before about the leadership of people of color and the environmental justice community and energy democracy as setting a direction. The fact that people rise up does not always result in good conditions. You know, people often have been seen to rise up in a very politically reactionary way. In fact, this is what the whole Trump presidency has shown, is that right-wing fascist forces create chaos. And out of chaos, they promise order and they promise dictatorship as a way of solving problems. So the fact that conditions will get worse and people will rise up doesn't mean anything positive unless we have a model and a movement that can point to a direction that really addresses questions of justice more than questions of greenhouse gas reductions, frankly, because that's what we've seen for the last 30 years. Is that, you know, a movement that's been focused just on a technological transition without looking at the real political power questions has fallen short. So we need to move in a direction that recognizes that the climate emergency creates opportunities to empower our communities to take control of resources. That is the only way that we're going to really survive on the planet. And, you know, the corporate infrastructure and those powers that be will always use a climate emergency in order to try to cement their control and their solution of the problem. I mean, just imagine giving the Trump administration emergency powers to deal with the climate situation and what that could have meant.
Yeah, I agree with how the neo-fascist right operates by sowing chaos with their street wing, while their political wing is running on a platform of law and order and a return to national greatness. They present an enormous threat to us and the planet and to the possibilities of a decent society. And it has to be met, and the climate action movements have to be involved in undermining their power and reaching out to the people that they're reaching. As to the climate movement, it must be more than inclusive of everybody. It has to be more than inclusive. It has to include everybody in this country and internationally. All of our faiths are intertwined. We need international cooperation. And to take power from the powerful, the now powerful, the corporate set, the bankers and financiers and all of their servants, that requires accepting and reaching out to every social sector in this country with an explicit program as we are reconstructing the economy and particularly the energy system, which lies at the center of any modern economy. The benefits of the reconstruction have to flow first to those who have lived on the edge economically and humiliated and punished socially. Climate justice and economic justice are indispensable for building the forces to stop global roasting. Al Weinreb, it's been great talking to you. Thanks so much.
You're welcome, Bill. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks very much.